So a little poll to open things up this morning. I'm going to ask you to go back to your high school years. So some of you are going to have to dig deep, think back to those high school years. Hopefully they're fond thoughts. And maybe think back to American Lit class or maybe AP English Composition and Literature, something along those lines. And raise your hand if in one of those classes you were required to read Jonathan Edwards' sermon, Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God. Just raise your hand if you're required to read that. Hold them nice and high so I can see you. All right. So I'm noticing something already in the room. Okay, how many of you who were in high school after 2000 actually had to read that sermon? After 2000, read that sermon in it. All right, a few hands. But that's proving what I thought would be the case, which is namely, back in the mid-20th century, 80% of students would have read that sermon as part of their high school curriculum. But if you were looking around the room, that number is now basically down in single digits. There's been a big shift away from that kind of thought. And I was considering it just because this is the week of the anniversary of that sermon when Edwards preached it back in 1741. And that cultural shift reflects really as a society, I think, many of the ways we've moved away from Edwards, from the Puritans. We actually love to mock them. We love to mock how they thought, how they taught. So that famous sermon is often now mocked as an exercise in sheer cruelty, right? The portrait painted for many of a capricious, vindictive deity who delights, right, in dangling human beings like spiders over a fire. And I wonder if that's how some of you actually think about God this morning. Do you think about God in that way, that God is just some celestial bully upstairs, that he is this petulant deity, right, with unrelenting fury? Maybe that's how you think about God. Or maybe you've come this morning and you actually think about God very differently from that Edwards sermon. Maybe your view of God is that he is all smiles and no frowns, right, that he carries no gavel. Your God makes no distinctions. There is no condemnation, only validation. I wonder how you would answer those questions. Which side, maybe, of the scales would you fall as you think about God? And friends, that's actually going to bring us to our study in Genesis this morning. So let me invite you to turn with me to Genesis 18. We're going to begin in verse 16, and we're going to run from Genesis 18, 16, all the way through chapter 19. And if you've got, if you don't have a Bible with you, we provide those red Bibles in the seat back before you. I think you can find our passage around page 11, 12, 13, somewhere right in there. And we've been in this series, if you're just joining us, this series called The Life of Faith, and we've been following Abraham, the quintessential man of faith. And we've seen that despite all the ups and downs, all of his successes and failures, that God has not given up on this beleaguered couple. God, indeed, as we saw last week, he confirms his covenant with Abraham, and he makes glorious promises to Abraham that out of Abraham he would make a great people and a great nation. And yet, what should mark that nation? How should that great people live? And what happens when those who blatantly would scorn God's standards and those who would despise his design, those who would shake their fists at God, right? What happens to them? Well, that's what drops us right into Genesis 18, again, all the way through chapter 19. So I want you to follow along, if you will, as I read, and just buckle up. This is probably our longest section in this series in Genesis. And it's not only long, it is admittedly a heavy passage. And so just parents with young children, this is one of those Sundays where I'm going to try to be very careful not to overly sensationalize what is here in Genesis. And yet at the same time, I don't want to overly soften either. So I'll try to navigate that, and I trust if at any moment you need to navigate that with your own children, I understand. Okay, so let's pick up Genesis 18, beginning in verse 16. Then the men set out from there, and they looked down towards Sodom, and Abraham went with them to set them on their way. And the Lord said, "Shall I hide from Abraham what I'm about to do? seeing that Abraham shall surely become a great and mighty nation, and all the nations of the earth shall be blessed in him. For I have chosen him, that he may command his children and his household after him to keep the way of the Lord by doing righteousness and justice, so that the Lord may bring to Abraham what he has promised him. Then the Lord said, because the outcry against Sodom and Gomorrah is great, and their sin is very grave, I will go down to see whether they have done altogether according to the outcry that has come to me. And if not, I will know. So the men turned from there and went toward Sodom. But Abraham still stood before the Lord. Then Abraham drew near and said, will you indeed sweep away the righteous with the wicked? Suppose there are 50 righteous within the city. Will you sweep away the place and not spare it for the 50 righteous who are in it? Far be it from you to do such a thing, to put the righteous to death with the wicked, so that the righteous fare as the wicked. Far be that from you. Shall not the judge of all the earth do what is just? And the Lord said, if I find at Sodom 50 righteous in the city, I will spare the whole place for their sake. Abraham answered and said, behold, I've undertaken to speak to the Lord, I who am but dust and ashes. Suppose 5 of the 50 righteous are lacking. Will you destroy the whole city for the lack of 5? Then he said, I will not destroy it if I find 45 there. Again, he spoke to him and said, suppose 40 are found there. He answered, for the sake of 40, I will not do it. And he said, oh, let not the Lord be angry, and I will speak. Suppose 30 are found there. And he answered, I will not do it if I find 30 there. He said, behold, I've undertaken to speak to the Lord. Suppose 20 are found there. And he answered, for the sake of 20, I will not destroy it. And he said, oh, let not the Lord be angry, and I will speak again but this once. Suppose 10 are found there. And he answered, for the sake of 10, I will not destroy it. And the Lord went his way, and he'd finished speaking to Abraham, and Abraham returned to his place. The two angels came to Sodom in the evening, and Lot was sitting in the gate of Sodom. And when Lot saw them, he rose to meet them and bowed himself with his face to the earth and said, my lords, please turn aside to your servant's house and spend the night and wash your feet. Then you may rise up early and go on your way. And they said, no, we will spend the night in the town square. But he pressed them strongly. So they turned aside to him and entered his house. And he made them a feast and baked unleavened bread, and they ate. But before they lay down, the men of the city, the men of Sodom, both young and old, all the people to the last man, surrounded the house. And they called to Lot, where are the men who came to you tonight? Bring them out to us that we may know them. Lot went out to the men at the entrance and shut the door after him and said, I beg you, my brothers, do not act so wickedly. Behold, I have 2 daughters who have not known any man. Let me bring them out to you and do to them as you please. Only do nothing to these men, for they have come under the shelter of my roof. But they said, stand back. And they said, this fellow came to sojourn, and he has become judge. Now we will deal worse with you than with them. And then they pressed hard against the man Lot and drew near to break the door down. But the men reached out their hands and brought Lot into the house with them and shut the door. And they struck with blindness the men who were at the entrance of the house, both great and small. So they wore themselves out, groping for the door. Then the men said to Lot, have you anyone else here? Sons-in-law, sons, daughters, or anyone you have in the city, bring them out of this place. For we are about to destroy this place because the outcry against its people has become great before the Lord, and the Lord has sent us to destroy it. So Lot went out and said to his sons-in-law who were to marry his daughters, up, get out of this place. The Lord is about to destroy the city. But he seemed to his sons-in-law to be jesting. Well, as morning dawned, the angels urged Lot, saying, up. Take your wife and your 2 daughters who are here, lest you be swept away in the punishment of the city. But he lingered. And so the men seized him and his wife and his 2 daughters by the hand, the Lord being merciful to him. And they brought him out and set him outside the city. And as they brought him out, one said, escape for your life. Do not look back or stop anywhere in the valley. Escape to the hills, lest you be swept away. And Lot said to them, oh no, my lords, behold, your servant has found favor in your sight, and you have shown me great kindness in saving my life. But I cannot escape to the hills, lest this disaster overtake me and I die. Behold, this city is near enough to flee to, and it's a little one. Let me escape there. Is it not a little one? And my life will be saved. He said to him, behold, I grant you this favor also, that I will not overthrow the city of which you have spoken. Escape there quickly, for I can do nothing till you arrive there. Therefore, the name of the city was called Zoar. The sun had risen on the earth when Lot came to Zoar. And then the Lord rained on Sodom and Gomorrah, sulfur and fire from the Lord out of heaven. And he overthrew those cities and all the valley and all the inhabitants of the cities and what grew on the ground. But Lot's wife behind him looked back, and she became a pillar of salt. And Abraham went early in the morning to the place where he stood before the Lord. And he looked down toward Sodom and Gomorrah and toward all the land of the valley. And he looked, and behold, the smoke of the land went up like the smoke of a furnace. So it was that when God destroyed the cities of the valley, God remembered Abraham and sent Lot out of the midst of the overthrow when he overthrew the cities in which Lot had lived. Now Lot went up out of Zoar and lived in the hills with his two daughters, for he was afraid to live in Zoar. So he lived in a cave with his two daughters. And the firstborn said to the younger, our father is old, and there is not a man on the earth to come in after us in the manner of all the earth. Come, let us make our father drink wine, and we will lie with him, that we may preserve offspring from our father. And so they made their father drink wine that night. And the firstborn went in and lay with her father. He did not know when she lay down or when she arose. The next day the firstborn said to the younger, behold, I lay last night with my father. Let us make him drink wine tonight also. Then you go in and lie with him, that we may preserve offspring from our father. And so they made their father drink wine that night also. And the younger arose and lay with him, and he did not know when she lay down or when she arose. And thus both the daughters of Lot became pregnant by their father. The firstborn bore a son and called his name Moab. He is the father of the Moabites to this day. And the younger also bore a son and called his name Ben-Ammi. And he is the father of the Ammonites to this day. All right. Well, what we have here in many ways is actually a kind of courtroom drama, where we're actually being led into the court of divine justice. And it's as if we're brought into the scene and we're seated up in the balcony and we're really watching from the hills of Hebron as this all unfolds. So notice in verses 16 to 21, as the passage opens, chapter 18, 16 to 21, there's a charge that is brought before the divine bench. There's an outcry, right? Verse 20, verse 21, and that outcry reaches God's ears, the divine judge. And that word for outcry that is there in 20 and 21, and then later in chapter 19, verse 13, it is actually a legal term. It is a cry for justice against the sin of Sodom. And then in verses 22 and 23, there's a kind, if you will, of pretrial motion. Abraham makes a plea for mercy. Verse 23, he says, will you indeed sweep away the righteous with the wicked? And then verse 25, shall not the judge of all the earth do what is just? And what do we see? But the judge grants leniency. Right? If only 10 righteous people are in the city, then the entire city will be saved. And then in 19, 1 to 11, well, what happens? But the evidence is presented. And we get eyewitness accounts of the absolute moral corruption of Sodom. 10 righteous people, at best, there is one righteous person, it seems, left in Sodom. And then in 19, 12 to 22, we get the verdict. Right, chapter 19, verse 13. For we are about to destroy this place because the outcry, right, that charge that has come against its people has become great before the Lord, and the Lord has sent us to destroy it. And yet not before Lot and his family are given a chance to escape. And then in verses 23 to 29, we witness the sentence, right? 1924, the Lord rained on Sodom and Gomorrah, sulfur and fire from the Lord out of heaven. And then it all closes and we get the aftermath there in 1930 to 38, where Lot and his daughters flee to the caves, and then they trick their father into this drunken, incestuous relationship in order to continue their family line. Now, friends, admittedly, this is one of the darker passages in all of Scripture. But I also want you to note this is not a passage without hope. For in all of the smoldering ashes, we see actually God extending mercy. There is mercy. And I think in a nutshell, what we can take away from our text is that the intercession of the righteous one saves the remnant from God's judgment. And we're going to sort of capture all of it, put it together. It's that the intercession of the righteous one saves the remnant from God's judgment. And so let's just walk through that courtroom drama together. Let's follow it along. So if you missed it as I walked through it initially, we're just going to go through it again. All right, let's think first about the charge. First, the charge that's brought. This is really chapter 18, verses 16 to 21, opening verses. And the scene picks up where we left off last week. So the Lord and his two messengers, they finished their meal with Abraham, and they look out from Hebron, they look out from the hills down to the valley below, and we read there, verse 20, that this great outcry has come up from Sodom and Gomorrah. And again, that word outcry, it's a legal term, a judicial term. It's a formal cry of one who is oppressed. So if you think back to Genesis 4, when in Genesis 4:10, Abel's blood was what? Crying out from the ground. It's the same verb. Or think of Exodus 3, when God's people are being persecuted in Egypt. They're being oppressed. And in Exodus 3, they cry out to God. Again, same verb. And we read in verse 20 that the sin of Sodom is very grave. And that expression actually picks up back what God said about the sin of the earth in Noah's day, how the sin was very grave back then. And it appears that Sodom is a kind of cesspool of sin, which shouldn't really surprise us because back in chapter 13, when we read Lot was moving there, we were told in 13:13 that the men of Sodom were wicked, that they were great sinners against the Lord. And we're seeing more about what that sin entailed this morning. And so God poses a rhetorical question to Abraham. A rhetorical question to Abraham, really to the angelic messengers, and Abraham's listening in. And he says, verse 17, shall I hide from Abraham what I'm about to do? All right, what am I about to do to Sodom? Should I basically let him into my courtroom? Should I give him an opportunity to see and to hear what's about to take place? And God tells him that yes, he's going to let him into the courtroom of divine justice. Because if Abraham is to be a great and mighty nation, he needs to understand the principles by which this new people and new nation must live. Right, verse 19. God says, I have chosen him that he may command his children and his household after him to keep the way of the Lord by doing righteousness and justice. And just notice right there, that is exactly how grace and the law work in the gospel. So notice first, God always shows grace. That is the foundation. It's grace. I have chosen you, God says to Abraham. And then in response to that grace, what do we have? We have, well, that he should follow God and his offspring in righteousness and justice. Right? It's Ephesians 2. For by grace you have been saved. Right? Saved so that we should what? Walk in good works, right? Grace and then followed by obedience. And this is what, verse 19, Abraham is to command all of his children and all of his household. Now, we often forget there were no formal schools in Israel, like not for another 1,000+ years. And so the family was the source of all education. And I'm not saying that because I'm saying like this is a proof text for homeschooling, right? So don't walk away with that. But it is a reminder that all spiritual education, friends, begins and ends really in the home. Not in the schools, right? You can even go to a Christian school, Shiloh, with amazing teachers, Chris Sutterfield, Natalie Davey, right? Amazing teachers. But that's actually not where the core of our spiritual formation and education as children is meant to take place. Not even in the church. Not even that is meant to be the center where such spiritual formation takes place. It begins right there in the home with parents teaching and instructing their children in the ways. And that's why as a church, one of the things we want to do in our youth ministries, right? We want to actually equip parents as best they can to be instilling God's truth and God's word into the hearts of their children, helping them know what it means to obey and to follow him and love him and cherish him. And yet, because the sin is very grave, verse 21, God says he's going to have to go down to see, right? I will go down and see basically what's happening in Sodom. And just to be clear, when God says he will go down and see, that's not God professing ignorance. It's not God saying, like, I need to go acquire information I don't have. This is the language in the Bible of accommodation, of God speaking to us in terms that we could understand. And if you remember back with Babel, it's the same language. Back in 11:5, right, when they're building the tower, what does God say? But the Lord, what, came down to see the city and the tower? Same language. It's God's way of saying that he is going to investigate the crimes, right, the charges. He's going to investigate them thoroughly and investigate them fully. So that's the charge against Sodom. Now we get the motion. Second, the motion. This is the kind of pretrial motion that Abraham brings. Now, if you've ever traveled overseas, perhaps you've been to a market, right? Perhaps you've been to a bazaar, and one of the things you'll come to find is there's a kind of a price for the good, but the price is always negotiable. It's always negotiable. And it's all about haggling. So let's just say, for the sake of argument, you're Magnolia Hughes, and you're in Italy, and you really like a bag, and you'd love to get that bag. You're like, oh, $50. What about $40? Would you take $40? Well, how about $30? Should you take $30? And the haggling begins. And some of you love that moment. I'm not going to call you out. One of you said, Brad, if you ever need to go buy a car at Toyota of Fayetteville, I will go for you and I will haggle. Like, I love it. I'm thinking, you and I are so different. I don't know what to do with that. But some of you love that. You love the kind of haggling. And you might think that's what's happening here, but that would be a misunderstanding. That's not really what's happening here. This isn't Abraham bartering with God like they're at some bazaar. This is Abraham, and he's drawing near to the bench, and he's petitioning the judge. And this is where the drama picks up, verse 23. Because he drew near and said, will you indeed sweep away the righteous with the wicked? Suppose there are 50 righteous within the city. Will you sweep away the place and not spare it for the 50 righteous who are in it? Far be it from you to do such a thing, to put the righteous to death with the wicked, so the righteous fare as the wicked. Far be that from you, shall not the judge of all the earth do what is just? You see, Abraham is offering this motion, if you will, on the basis of what he knows about God's own character, that he is a just God, and this just God will not stand for the perversion of justice. Such that every time we hear that an innocent person has been convicted, maybe sitting on death row for decades, or anytime we hear that a guilty person goes free, like, we feel that injustice. We feel that sense of anger and frustration in our own hearts because we're image bearers. And that's part of how we image God, reflect God as he is. And notice Abram's petition, it's bold. And it's a reminder that when we come to God, and we come to him on the basis of his character and his nature and his word, we can pray bold prayers to God. We can make great petitions to God. I mean, so often in the Psalms, what do we see but great and bold petitions made to God on the basis of his character, of who he is? Because we know the judge of all the earth will do what is just and right. And Christian, I hope in that you find great confidence, right? When we can't understand, when we throw up our hands in confusion and frustration and we are unable to make sense of why, right? Why did I lose my job? Why did I lose my baby? or my marriage? Or why did my child walk away from the faith? Or why did I receive that diagnosis? Or whatever it is. We can go to God, big, bold prayers, and we can pray trusting that the judge of all the earth will do what is just. And that one day he will right every wrong, and so we can leave it to him, and we can bring these prayers to him, and then we can trust him. Psalm 145, 17. The Lord is righteous in all of his ways, and faithful in all he does. Recognize, I think this is the first prayer of petition in all the Bible. First prayer petition in all the Bible. And it's a daring prayer, and it's a deferential prayer. Abraham, he's coming to the bench, right? Basically coming, right, Dustin Ash, he's coming your honor. He's coming respectfully. He's showing the proper decorum. And he makes this petition. And he makes this intercession. And friends, I hope you see in that petition and you see in that intercession the reminder of the one who ever lives to intercede for us. Hebrews 7. For notice verse 25, Abraham is saying, he's saying, will you sweep away the place, as in the whole city, and not spare it for the sake of the righteous? So notice what Abraham is not saying. He's not saying, if there are 50 righteous people, will you spare just those 50 righteous people? No, he's saying, if there's 50 righteous people, will you spare the entire city? That's what he's asking. And then the numbers keep dropping. What about for the sake of 40, 30, all the way down to 10? And friends, what I want you to recognize is that is substitutionary deliverance. It's pictured right there. It's substitutionary deliverance. It's just how the gospel works, right? We are not spared, any of us, because we are righteous before God. We are spared because another righteous one stood in our stead, and he took our place as our substitute, right? 1 Peter 3:18. Christ also suffered once for sins, the righteous for the unrighteous, that he might bring us to God. And that's exactly what we have here. And friends, Jesus is uniquely qualified to be that intercessor and Savior because he alone is uniquely righteous. Which means, Christian, when you blow it, and sadly we do, when you blow it, you don't have to panic. You don't have to fear in that moment. You have forever lost God. Because you know you have an advocate before the Father. One who takes the rap sheet of all your sin, and he takes that rap sheet and he buries it in the grave. So that when Satan comes to condemn you, and Satan would come and stand in that courtroom, and he would pull out this long list and say to the judge, say to the Lord Almighty, look at this long list of heinous sins. Look at what this person has done. Look what a worthless Christian they are. In that moment, you have an advocate, and you have one who says, cries out, objection, Your Honor. I have already paid for that. I have paid for it in full. Every single one, I have paid for it. And that objection is sustained as the Father with a smile looks upon the Son and loves the Son and knows the work of the Son for his children. There is no condemnation for the one in Christ. And so we can have confidence before God, joy before God, security that this one who has loved us so and saved us, he keeps us to the very end. Well, this brings us thirdly to the testimony. Third, we come to the testimony, chapter 19, verses 1 to 11. The evidence has been presented now. This is what we have. This is that moment where the evidence is being presented. And what do we find? Well, two men in 19:1 are going to come down right from the hills of Hebron. And what do we read in 19:1? We read they're angels. We've been referring to them as angels. We know that just because of 19:1. And it's significant that there are two of them, right? Those little details aren't accidental because in the Old Testament, capital punishment requires at least two witnesses. There have got to be two witnesses to what's taking place. And they arrive, 19:1, and they arrive in the evening. The meaning there is it's black. It's fitting for the moral blackness of the city. God came to Abraham with the messengers in the middle of the day. Here, they're coming, and it's as black as night. And who's sitting at the gate but Lot himself? Now, remember, Lot is Abraham's nephew. So Abraham and Lot are family. And we can appreciate now why Abraham was interceding so for Sodom, because Lot's there and he knows Lot's there. And it's been over a decade since we've seen Lot. And at first glance, life's looking up for Lot, right? So back in chapter 13, they were together. There was a bit of scuffling between their shepherds. Lot has to move. There's space is too small for them. And so he chooses those well-watered, fertile valleys down in the plain. He chooses that land near Sodom. And so he goes there. And we noted back then that that's always ominous. When you travel east of Eden in Genesis, that's a bad direction. And that's the direction Lot goes. And remember the progression. At first, Lot's living near Sodom. And then we read in chapter 14, he's living in Sodom. And now, here, chapter 19, what do we read? Lot is literally sitting in the city gate, the place of highest prominence and power in the community. And notice how he refers to the Sodomites. He refers to them as his brothers, 19:6. We read even his daughters are engaged to men of the city, verse 14. Right? Lot's come a long way. But at what cost? At what cost? At what cost to Lot's moral and spiritual life? At what cost to Lot's own soul? It turns out Lot is going to pay a terribly high price. For there's no way to live comfortably in a place like Sodom without compromise. There's just no way to do it, to live comfortably in a place like Sodom without compromise. So just a word to those of you who are younger in the room, right? Maybe you're heading into high school, you're in high school, maybe you're in college, whatever it might be. If you're going to fit in, one of the things you learn quite quickly when you're young, if you want to fit in and if you want to be accepted into a community, like Lot has been accepted into this community, if you want your place, like in the city gate, right, whether that's at school or that's on a sports team or that's in a fraternity or sorority, one of the things you'll learn is you're going to be called to compromise. You're going to be called to make compromises. And I wonder if you know anything of that temptation. Maybe to compromise your beliefs. Maybe to compromise sort of the things you approve and disapprove of. Maybe you're called to compromise the kind of jokes you laugh at, right? You feel compelled to laugh at the things that the other folks are laughing at, or maybe to approve of the things they're approving of, maybe to see and watch what they watch, to see and say, right, what they say. And we often think those compromises gain us standing. They gain us approval. They gain us acceptance. And the reality is, in the moment, they might. In the moment, they might. But in the end, those compromises are going to cost Lot everything. And friend, they're going to do the same for you if you're not careful. Because you can't make peace with the world and still be a friend of God. Now, when Lot rises and offers to host these guests, notice they decline. They're like, oh, we're going to stay right in the town square. But notice, what does Lot do then? He presses them strongly, verse 3. It's actually the same pressing later referred to how the city presses back against him, I think, in verse 9. There's lots of pressure. In other words, Lot applies to these men. It's as if Lot already knows the men are at great risk. Perhaps that's why he suggests to them, hey, listen, come stay with me and rise up early. Get out of the way. Get out the gate before the city knows you're here. That's the sense we're getting. It makes you wonder how many times had other weary travelers come to Sodom and made the same mistake that was these two angels do, right? How many times has maybe Lot turned a blind eye to the ways of Sodom? We don't know. And yet while the men come and he's making the meal, what happens? But word gets out, and now men surround Lot's house. Verse 4, what do we read? Both young and old, all the people, to the last man. It seems the entire male population has come, and they clearly have not come peacefully. So the likelihood at this point of 10 righteous men in the city, right, that likelihood is dropping precipitously, like dropping fast. Maybe again, maybe one. And they demand Lot turn his guests over so that they can, what, quote, verse 5, know them. Quote, know them, which is just a biblical euphemism for have sex with them. They want to sexually abuse Lot's two guests, to dominate, to degrade, to humiliate them. That's what they want. And notice Lot begs and pleads with them. He even proffers his own virgin daughters instead of them. You know, if your stomach wasn't already turning in this episode, at that point, like, it is an utter knots. It's just revulsion. Right? Lot's solution seems far more heinous than even the heinous sin Sodom is proposing. And, you know, maybe Lot's offer here of his two daughters, maybe that's a genuine offer. Or maybe because Lot knows his daughters are engaged and he knows the punishment for sleeping with someone like that would be a capital punishment, would be death. Maybe that's Lot's way of trying to awaken their conscience. Don't do this thing. Don't do this wicked thing. It's hard to know. We don't know. I'd like to think it's the latter. I just don't know. What we do know is the men don't go for it. Either way, they don't go for it. And if it weren't for the angels then blinding all the men and pulling Lot and rescuing him back into the home, the people said they would have even done worse to Lot. Right? Someone like cancel culture, we think that's a new thing. Like, they're canceling him already here. Well, from this passage, friends, it's where we get our word sodomy. It's why sodomy laws are actually still on the books in 12 states, even if they can't be enforced. And you know, in the culture wars that we have, a passage like this has become a highly debated passage. So just a quick word on what's happening here. Those who would in our culture, and those who would profess to be Christians in our culture, and those who would profess to be Christians and who accept homosexuality, what they do is they make this passage all about a lack of hospitality. They would say that is the principal sin. Sort of a lack of hospitality and a social injustice. And that's what they would say. And they would not say God is condemning homosexuality. It's just condemning sort of the lack of hospitality, the oppression. And if that's how more religious liberals would read this passage, evangelicals tend to read it as a passage that is solely about homosexuality. Right? God here is condemning same-sex relationships, right? All of them consensual, not all of them together. So for liberals, it's a passage all about hospitality. For evangelicals, it's all about homosexuality. And we're said, like, pick. Which one is it? Friends, I think we're going to be faithful to the Bible. We have to say it's actually about both. We have to say it's about both. What do I mean? Well, in the prophets, like Ezekiel 49, or Isaiah 1, or Jeremiah 23, they do specifically condemn Sodom for its lack of hospitality in an ancient Near East sense and social oppression. They do condemn it for that. And in many ways, this passage is meant to be in contrast to the kind of hospitality that Abram showed in 18:1-15, right? That contrast is real. But that's not everything, though. It's true, but it's not all. Romans 1, especially if you go to the New Testament, Jude 7, 2 Peter 2 that we read, they do specifically highlight Sodom also for its sexual perversion. And I recognize even saying that, that is hard for some of our ears, because like Lot, we too can slowly accommodate and acculturate ourselves to modern ways of thinking. And we will reduce sin just to an alternative lifestyle. And that's what we'll call it. But God is condemning Sodom for both. Both the lack of hospitality, the great oppression, and for the homosexuality. Both are being condemned together. Which now brings us forth then to the verdict. Forth the verdict. Verses 12 to 22. Because friends, at this point, the judge, he's got his eyewitness testimony, and it is damning testimony. And he has all that he needs. And so 19 verse 13, what do we read? That we are about to destroy this place because the outcry against its people has become great before the Lord, and the Lord has sent us to destroy it. You know, these are those moments where, like, when you see angels out in, like, card shops, there are sometimes those precious moment angels, right? Those little chubby fat guys, you just pinch their cheeks. Like, that is so not the picture of angels in the Bible, friends. Like, these guys are about to rain down terrifying judgment. Sulfur and fire. And so Lot warns. He warns the dudes engaged to his daughters. He goes and he warns them of this coming judgment. right? Maybe those guys were some of the very men at the house. They've said all the men, right? Maybe they were there. We don't know. And yet when he warns them, how do they take Lot's warning? Verse 14, Lot seemed to them to be jesting. It seemed like a jest. The word is actually a kind of laugh, as if they take it as a joke. And it's the same word used of Sarah's laugh back in chapter 18, a kind of dismissive, a kind of mocking laugh. It's that kind of laugh that they have. And it makes you wonder, are they laughing at Lot because Lot never told them about the Lord? Are they laughing because this is the first time they've ever heard there's a God who might possibly bring about judgment, who's got moral standards? Maybe it's the first time they're hearing of such things. Well, the reality is, friends, it's easy to be dismissive of divine judgment. And maybe, like, you're dismissive this morning. You mock the very idea, right? Divine judgment, destruction, like we read here. Maybe for you that is just a simple, cheap way that religious people, like, they pull this out in order to control and to manipulate others. And that's how many people think about divine judgment. That's how Karl Marx talked about it. That's how Richard Dawkins talks about it. Bill Maher, same thing, right? It's just cheap manipulation and control. But the Bible would note this kind of mockery of God's judgment. It's actually not new. It's not at all, right? This doctrine has always been mocked. It was mocked in Jesus' day, right? It's mocked in Sodom's day. We're seeing it here. Remember, it was mocked back in Noah's day. They mocked it as well. Friends, that's because this notion that God might judge, that was mocked all the way back in the garden. When Satan said to the woman, "You will not surely die." And we've been believing his lies ever since. You know, C.S. Lewis in the Screwtape Letters, he notes that one of the easiest ways and one of the best ruses Satan has for keeping God's people to believe the truth is by getting them to believe that truth is ridiculous, like utterly ridiculous. But friends, just because something might appear to you at first glance to be utterly ridiculous does not mean that it is not right. All right. So when the first professing Christian said, "Hey, world, I actually think the earth revolves around the sun and not the other way," that may have seemed ridiculous, but he was actually right. Just because something may seem ridiculous to you does not mean it is logically not true. And yet as morning dawns, still yet, what does Lot do? Verse 16. He knows judgment's coming. What does he do? Verse 16, he lingers. He lingers. I don't know about you, but when I first read the story, like, that was the most arresting line maybe of the entire story to me. Lot knows the city is wicked. He knows God's judgment is coming. He knows there's no hope for it. There's no righteous people. And yet he lingers. He waits. Why does he do that? Friends, it's because his heart is divided. His heart is torn. It is literally being pulled in two directions, right? It seems his house, all of his possessions, all the worldly goods and status and reputation, all those things he'd built up there in Sodom over the years, you could see he's looking back at them. He doesn't want to give them up. They still have a grip on his heart. He is not ready, right? If you've read Pilgrim's Progress, he is not ready to leave Vanity Fair. He's got a wonderful life there. And yet, even as he does leave, notice, what does he do? He tries to negotiate, really, for a new city. He's not willing to give up the city. Like, he wants Zoar, it's a smaller city. Will you give that to me instead? And friends, again, I think that's a warning for us that when we make peace with the world, it is increasingly difficult for us to hear and to heed the voice of God. When we make peace with the world, it is increasingly difficult for us to hear and to heed the voice of God. Did you notice what had to happen? The men had to, verse 16, they had to seize Lot. They literally had to grab hold of him. And then when we read, the Lord being merciful to him. You know, if I'm God, I'm like, at this point, Lot, if you still want to stay, that is your choice. But thankfully, God's not like us. And he's like, "Lot, you are so dumb, I'm just going to save you anyway." And he just grabs him and ushers him out. The Lord being merciful. the Lord laid hold of the man who simply could not let go of the world. And in mercy, he saved him. Friends, that is a reminder again that what we have seen already, salvation, it is all of grace. Salvation is all of grace. And it's a beautiful picture of what we heard read in 2 Peter 2. If God rescued righteous Lot, greatly distressed by the sensual conduct of the wicked, then the Lord knows how to rescue the godly from trials and to keep the unrighteous under punishment until the day of judgment. Which means, Christian, he knows how to rescue you. He knows how to rescue you. And I don't know about you, but that is a great encouragement for me. Because I'm reading, and the more I read, the more I can see of myself in Lot. We like to think we're not Lot. We like to think we're Abraham. We are not Abraham in this story. We are Lot at best. And there is that willingness in all of us, what, to compromise. A willingness to make peace where we shouldn't make peace, to shy away, to speak little of divine judgment, to make this life my best life. And if that's you, the wonderful promise is, in spite of that struggle in your life, God still promises to save you, to rescue you, sustain you, keep you. That's his grace, and we see it at work here. It's all over these verses. Notice God puts the entire timetable of this destruction on hold. Lot's lingering, and he's like, all right, everyone, time out. I got to get Lot out. And he waits. That's the kindness and the grace of God. It's a wonderful picture of his mercy. I love when we sing the line, the stanza, he will hold me fast. When the tempter would prevail, the tempter does prevail sometimes. When he would prevail, he will hold me fast. I could never keep my hold through life's fearful past, for my love is often cold. He must hold me fast. And he does, and he will. Which brings us fifth to the sentence. The sentence, that's chapter 19, verses 23 to 29. And we got to recognize, if this were a Hollywood film, major motion production, all the attention would be right here. Right here. All the fires and the people fleeing, right? The cries, the chaos, the commotion. This would become like an hour-long scene. And given all of the buildup into this moment, it's remarkable, in fact, how brief and how terse the description is. Because as we've seen already, back even with Noah, right? The Bible does not concern itself with all the salacious details. It's really our response and what we understand to be happening. That's what matters. It's the response of the characters that God wants to point our attention to. Because while Lot and his daughters, yeah, they're finally fleeing, what do we read about Lot's wife? Verse 26. Where is she? She's behind him. Maybe she lingered longer. And she looked back, and she became a pillar of salt. Now, we read that, I think. And, like, our first thought is, what, this poor girl, like, glanced over her shoulder and she just smote right there? Well, it's not a casual glance. That's not what that word looked is implying. It suggests a kind of tense gaze. It suggests a deep longing in her own heart, that her heart and her affections were still bound and still tied back there in Sodom. And so it's why Jesus in Luke 17, when he's warning about his future coming, do you remember what Jesus says? Jesus simply says, remember Lot's wife. Whoever seeks to preserve his life will lose it. But whoever loses his life will keep it. She wanted to preserve her life back in Sodom. That's where her heart was. That was what's at issue. Christian, let Lot's wife be a warning to you. A warning not to look back at the world, not to linger and wonder, but to rather make that break. Make that break from sin. Make it clear. Make it decisive. Make it clean. Make it now before it's too late. Now, by verse 27, the camera pulls back and we're back up in the hills now and we're looking up at Abraham and he's standing over the whole plains observing this. And all Abraham sees now is a burnt wasteland. All he sees is everything now turned to ash. Nothing left alive, right? Nothing moving but the crackling of embers and the suffocating smoke that continues to billow up to the sky. That's all that's there. Verse 29, we read, "So it was that when God destroyed the cities of the valley, God remembered Abraham and sent Lot out of the midst." Well, wait, what's that? How did God remember Abraham? He remembered him by honoring his intercession. There may not have been 10 righteous men in the city, but by Abraham's intercession, Lot was warned and Lot was saved. And notice that's the second time Abraham has saved Lot's hide. A reminder and proof that the judge of all the earth does what is right and does not treat the righteous and the wicked alike. Which is why we read and confessed from our statement of faith at the opening. Some of you may have been like, that was an awkward way to open. Well, it's illustrating the very point here in Genesis. And this leads us all sixth to the aftermath. Sixth, the aftermath. The verdict has been rendered, now the sentence has been executed, and now here we are. And it seems Lot somehow became persona non grata in Zoar. Maybe they realized he was somewhat to blame for what happened, or they thought he was to blame, whatever. He escapes and goes to the hills. And he lives in a cave. And that is a picture of poverty. It's a picture of isolation. It's a picture of destitution. And do you see how Lot's fortunes have fallen? Do you see how they've fallen? How Lot has gone from being a revered socialite to now a despised troglodyte. That's just a fun word for cave dweller, okay? That's what's happened to Lot. And ironically, notice the fate that his daughters almost suffered at his hands, he will now suffer at their hands. Did you see that? God always uses irony to help us see things in Scripture, because they're going to make him drink wine, and then they will use his body for their own shameful ends. It seems you could take the daughters out of Sodom, but you couldn't take Sodom out of the daughters. And so they would give birth to two races of people, the Moabites and the Ammonites. They'd be a thorn in Israel's side. And we're beginning to see how much the story reminds us of what? It reminds us of the flood. It's like Noah and the flood all over again. Because in both stories, what are we told at the outset? The sin was very grave. And in both stories, what do they try to do? These righteous ones try to warn the community. And what does the community do? They laugh, they mock, they scorn. And in both stories, only one family is saved. And in both, the Lord will rain down judgment from heaven, and he's going to bring total destruction. And both, notice, end with a sad story of drunkenness and sexual immorality. It's the same story retold. And we're seeing yet again that the effects of the curse are still live and well, because the one to crush the curse, the serpent crusher, we are still waiting, waiting for that seed. And you know the beautiful thing? We've talked about how in Genesis, God redeems what we've ruined. Through what family seed did that serpent crusher come? There was a descendant of Moab named Ruth. And God could even redeem what happened here and use a descendant of that wicked society, Moab, through Ruth to bring about the serpent crusher himself. Like time and time again, God redeeming what we've ruined. It's a beautiful thing. But the sad thing is, this is the last we hear of Lot. And it's such a tragedy, because his life, which began with such promise, it ends miserably. And some of you will know 1 Corinthians 3:15. Paul writes of the one who is saved. But remember, he writes of the one who is saved, yet as though only through the flames. The one saved, but only through the flames. And I remember reading that as a new Christian, and I'm like, I mean, yeah, but he's saved, right? I mean, he's saved. I mean, yes, it's through the flames. It's not great, But the guy's in heaven. He's saved. But friends, look at Lot again. Look at Lot. I think Lot is a picture of what Paul speaks of as one who is saved and yet here literally escapes as though through the flames. Everything in Lot's life, literally and metaphorically, is burned up. And yes, Lot makes it. He does. And yes, for a while he lived a good life. He tried to have both God and the world, but look how it ended. And Christian, do you want that life? Escaping through the flames. And as we step back, I think we've been challenged in another way. Because we've been challenged in how we're to think about God. That's how we opened. Right? Is God just the caricature that people make of Jonathan Edwards' sermon? Is he just some cruel, vindictive, petulant deity, right? Just terrorizes and brutalizes people at will? Well, not here. No way. The God in this, he's patient. He's forbearing. He is merciful, not wishing that any should perish, but all should come to repentance. The judgment of Sodom is not the sudden anger of just an irritable temper. This is not God flying off the handle. This is a measured judgment only after a full investigation of the facts. And yet, for those of us who think God is, well, he's all smiles and no frowns, right? This is a God who carries no gavel, makes no distinctions, right? No condemnation, only validation. Well, friends, that is not accurate either. God does distinguish. He finally does judge. And there will be no last minute reprieve. Right, there's going to be no higher court the Sodomites can appeal to. When God's judgment comes, there will be no second chances. This judgment, Jesus says, is but a foretaste of that judgment to come, which is why today is the day of salvation, because God is merciful. Don't mock him. The one who died and rose and now sits at the right hand of the Father is ready to intercede for you. If Christ freely offers salvation, why remain under condemnation? Receive him in his grace. Turn from your sin. Trust in him, because this one ever lives to intercede for you. For it is only the intercession of the righteous one that saves the remnant from God's judgment. Let's pray.